is Wednesday, September 25th. Good afternoon. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. On this National Coffee Day, you are listening to a well-caffeinated version of Studio 2. Thanks for joining us on WHYY. Cherry?
Yes.
I believe today's show was your idea, right? I mean, you kind of pitched this.
Yeah, I did pitch this because of the arrest of Sean Diddy Combs last week. I grew up, you know, Sean Diddy Combs, Bad Boy music was the soundtrack of my coming to of age years.
Yeah.
And
for
now,
people that don't know, it encompasses many artists.
Many artists.
He produced
Mary
a lot
J.
of artists.
Yes. Biggie Smalls or the Notorious B.I.G., 112, so many others, R&B, hip hop groups. He was very influential when it came to fashion and a whole lot more. And so the question started to come up. I mean, can I still listen to Sean Diddy Combs' music? Can I still listen to the music of the artist that he helped produce? It just created this dilemma because of the crimes he's been accused of.
And so our question for you today is, what do you do when a musician, actor, or artist that you love does something immoral or even criminal? Do you separate the art from the artist? I have a huge list of artists in front of me who have been accused of or convicted of doing horrible things. I'm looking at Woody Allen, R. Kelly, Roman Polanski, Phil Spector, Pablo Picasso, Louis C.K., Bill Cosby. There's someone on that list that I'm sure, if you are listening right now, you enjoy their work. So, do you still enjoy it, or have you decided to personally boycott it? 888-477-9499 or email us studio2@whyy.org.
Yeah, we have our trio of news stories. And first, this one is a little serious. Yesterday, the Upper Darby School Board unanimously voted to implement weapon detection systems at its high school and middle schools. Now, this comes after parents expressed concerns following the discovery of a loaded gun and an AR-style magazine at the high school. Pretty serious stuff, right? So they have this group, it's called Evolve Systems. They plan to use artificial intelligence to detect weapons. The program will cost over $1 million over the course of 4 years. Now, the implementation of this system will require significant adjustments with potential for long processing times, 40 to 60 minutes, and frequent searches of the students. Now, if you were looking at it on, if you were doing pros and cons for parents, a lot of them say, you know, safety is more important than logistical concerns. And supporters argue that weapons detection systems are commonplace in other venues. And so everybody's used to it. But against the parents who are against it say, I don't believe treating the entire community of children like potential criminals is the best way. Your thoughts, Avi?
Well, it reminds me of when I was an education reporter after the horrible massacre at Parkland High School in Florida. Excuse me, not Parkland High, down in Parkland, Florida. And after that, there was a huge amount of money that the state of Pennsylvania made available to school districts to do security upgrades. And we followed the money and we talked to superintendents all across the state who were taking advantage of this program. And I will never forget a conversation I had with a superintendent in rural Pennsylvania. This was maybe a year or so after Parkland at this point. And they had paid for a lot of security upgrades, all sorts of stuff. Yeah. It wasn't quite this level, but it was like this. And he was like, 10 years ago in our community, we did not even lock the doors at our schools.
Wow.
You know, the school was a place, it was an open door. Come on in, whoever you are. And he was, you know, lamenting the fact that he felt kind of compelled now to harden the school. And I do, this is happening everywhere.
Yeah.
The psychological effect of that cannot be measured, but I think it's real. And I think about that conversation every time I hear about one of these things being implemented. Not to say it's the wrong thing to do, because I understand why superintendents do it. But you have to remember, it's happening over and over and over again at school districts everywhere. And it is changing the way schools interface with their communities. 100%. I will always believe that.
Yeah, and I'll mention that the superintendent of the schools says that the decision to implement the system is not solely based on those recent incidents, but also, you know, based on broader concerns about student and adult behavior. We have so many guns on the streets, you know. And so this is a scary time. And I think folks just want to feel like they're doing something to save lives, to prevent shootings,
and to make people feel better.
To make people feel more comfortable.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know if it'll solve any problems, but at least folks feel like they're doing something. Yeah.
Right. It might not solve problems. I am convinced that it, I don't want to say creates problems, but it changes the atmosphere.
It does.
Of school every day for now, basically every kid in the country.
Yeah.
And that's something we should reckon with as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'll just never forget that conversation, you know, over 10 years going from our doors are unlocked to basically it was like they had like something like 100 cameras posted around this. You know, it was crazy. Anyways. Mm-hmm. So a story now that, oh, wow. How do you transition here? Much lighter story about gift cards, Jerry.
Yes.
A new study by Bankrate.
Mm-hmm.
Finds that 4 in 10 U.S. adults, about 43%, have at least one unused gift card. Among them, the average per person is $244. Add it all up, and there's $27 billion in unused gift cards in this country. Mm. Jerry, you are, I can tell, simmering with something, rage, confusion, something. What is it?
Well, I found a $50 gift card in a junk drawer just over the weekend.
Uh-huh.
Don't even remember who gave it to me, which
is bad.
What
was it for?
It was like an Amex gift card, so it could go anywhere.
Well, there's no excuse to waste that.
I know. Yeah. I don't know where it came from. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm one of those people with the $244 probably.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure if I looked around, I could probably find more.
I actually don't believe this. They say 4 in 10 U.S. adults have at least one unused gift card. That's got to be higher than that.
Yeah.
Is there anyone who doesn't have a single unused gift card somewhere? They probably just don't even remember that they have it somewhere.
Yeah. Or people who just left a few bucks on the gift card and then just forgot about it. You know what I mean? Like you just left a few bucks, let it go. And
$1.50 every time. Fun fact, but maybe not so fun. I did a little research. According to Smithsonian Magazine, the first company to truly market the gift card in its stores as a product was Blockbuster.
Look at you.
Blockbuster, ahead of its time.
I mean,
who would ever say that sentence? Blockbuster, ahead of its time.
You will find the historical nugget right there.
I got a whole rant about how Blockbuster has been maligned unfairly and that Netflix really overtook it because of venture capital, and you can watch a documentary about it. I won't even go there now. But I got a lot of love for Blockbuster.
Remember Netflix used to send you the DVDs in the mail?
Like Blockbuster did it too.
They did it too.
But Netflix got subsidized to do it. So they anyways, it's a whole rant.
It's a whole thing.
I'll save it for another time.
So, but I will say the one last thing on gift cards. It makes you think twice about giving a gift card if you know that you're just throwing the money away and the person may never use it. So maybe think twice about getting an actual gift. So I wanted to do this story because, you know, I'm obsessed with older people. My grandmother was like my person.
Okay,
so like
it.
We were besties. Okay. And the Philadelphia Inquirer did a really cool multimedia project. It's called Ask a Centarian. And it is one of the most delightful things that I've seen or heard in a long time. And this is how it worked. The Inquirer interviewed 14 people from Chester, Montgomery County, Delaware counties who are 100 years old or close to that age. And boy, it tickles you. Here's a clip of centarians answering the question, what does it feel like to be that age? Take a listen.
I'm 101 as of last April. And it feels wonderful because it's like I'm having a second chance.
I think it's great. I want to keep on going forever.
To me, it just don't seem exactly right to be that old.
Can you even imagine living to be 100 years old? It's so cute. And they also asked them questions about the secrets to lasting love, dating advice, the biggest changes they've seen in their life, and just some really other questions. And I have one more clip because they asked them to give advice to younger people, and here's what they had to say.
Keep active and don't take so many pills.
Not to give up. I mean, if things go bad, which they do, to work at it, seek advice.
And there you go. I mean, they just keep going.
You really enjoyed this.
I really did. I love asking people who look great. By the way, the oldest person interviewed who said it almost is kind of crazy to be this old, she was 109. 109. Avi.
I don't want to yuck your yum.
Okay.
I feel a little conflicted about this.
And why?
It feels sometimes, it's not this specific project. I'm not trying to put anybody down who participated, who did this. Sometimes this type of story feels patronizing to me.
I just love it, though.
A little infantilized. These are human beings. They have wisdom to share like other human beings. It doesn't hit me. It hits me different. I think we just feel differently about this type of story.
Yeah, they've seen so much, and I just love it. And to be able to keep going and look good.
And
I
we met rarely this guy disagree was, about things.
I met this guy. He was like 106, and he was still dancing. I want to be that. You know what I mean? If you make it to 106 and you still dancing, I want to know the secret. You know, anyway.
Okay.
Check it out on The Enquirer. Other pieces of advice, eat a lot of vegetables and keep it. That's all I do.
Nothing. I got nothing. I said my piece. I'm done.
Yes.
We just feel a little differently about this type of story. That's fair. That's fine. No, not every story is for everybody.
That is true. That is true.
And speaking of not everything being for everybody, lots of times, we hear very disappointing, sometimes disturbing things about the artists that we love. And a very natural reaction is to say, you know what? I'm done with this person. Mm-hmm. I'm done with their work. I don't want to support it anymore. So is that the moral response? Is it a myopic response? Well, we want to hear from you. What do you do when a musician, actor, or artist you love does something immoral? Email us, studio2@whyy.org, and we will talk about it right after this quick break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You know, if it's on, like, I don't know that I'm going to shut it off, but I'm not certainly buying anything of his coming out.
It's like with a lot of the other artists when something kind of happens. If it comes up on my playlist, I'll listen to it, but I'm not actively seeking it out because I don't really want to give them the money right now.
This is Studio 2. Welcome back. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. That was Nate and Aaron Thomas from Roxborough. Thanks for their contribution. You likely saw that music giant Sean Diddy Combs was arrested last week on charges that include sex trafficking, assault, and kidnapping. The hip-hop musician and producer has had an enormous influence on music for more than a generation. So the question arises, is it okay to still listen to his music or the music he produced for other artists?
And the list of artists, authors, musicians, directors who are accused of doing morally reprehensive things is long. We have R. Kelly, Woody Allen, Phil Spector, Picasso, Roman Polanski, Bill Cosby. So we want to know what you think. Can you, should you separate the art from the artist? That's our big question of today. If a musician, writer, director has behaved immorally, do you still enjoy the work that they created? Can you consume art created by bad people? You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499.
And we are so lucky to have two great guests with us this entire hour. Elizabeth Wellington is a Philadelphia Inquirer columnist who writes about gender, race, fashion, culture, and wellness. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we also have Eric Mathis, an associate professor at Wellesley College and the author of the book, Drawing the Line, What to Do with the Work of Immoral Artists from Museums to the Movies. Eric, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for everybody who's been calling in and sending in emails. We'll get to you in just a second. Elizabeth, I wanted to start the conversation with you. Because I know you created that project last year celebrating the 50th anniversary of hip hop. I know you're a fan of the music of Sean Diddy Combs. So give us your reaction to the news of his arrest for sex trafficking and all sorts of things. And then the questions it raised in your mind about whether you could enjoy that music.
Cherry, this is a hard one.
Yeah.
Because you adjusted in your seat, so I know it's hard.
Well, it's tough because I am of the generation that if you quote unquote cancel Puffy, I'm old enough to call him Puffy. So that should tell you.
Yeah, that's what he used to be called.
Puff Daddy.
Mm-hmm. But if you cancel Puffy, you got to cancel Total. You got to cancel Biggie. You got to cancel Mary J. Blige. You got to cancel Craig Mack. I mean,
the ripple effect.
The ripple effect. And so, you know, Diddy himself or Puff maybe had one or two singles. They weren't that great.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But it's the whole Bad Boy label that you wonder if it's problematic. And not only that, it was an era. It was a time. Like, he had a club in D.C. that was Love. I remember getting in my car, driving up there.
Yeah, I went to Love.
Mm-hmm. You would go to Bentley's, you know, in New York City. You know, he changed fashion. He was one of the only black male designers to be nominated by the Council of Fashion Design for his menswear collection. I mean, he has Ciroc. I mean, there's so much.
Oh, yeah, the vodka.
The vodka, right? So there's so much that Puff has brought to the culture. That aside, if you were paying attention, the white parties, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. That aside, if you were paying attention, you knew.
It was out there.
You knew that Puff was problematic, right? He was from the days of New York City and City College in the, I think it was like the late 90s. Mm-hmm. There was a big party at City College before he became Puff, and 9 people were killed in a stampede.
Mm.
So he has had a problematic background. We knew he wasn't necessarily the nicest guy.
And the label was called Bad Boy.
You complicated know, figure for sure.
So he's always been a complicated figure. The problem is that we just didn't know how complicated it was. And so as a young woman then, the money that I put in his pocket, I can't get that back. Mm-hmm. You know, going to, you know, whatever I spent my money on, whatever album I bought, I can't get that back. And it's painful to know that he used that money and that influence to basically be abusive and buy 1,000 bottles of baby oil. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know what I mean? So he used this to be abusive. So I could say that would I support him going forward? No. But if I hear, it's not just not listening to the music, it's wiping out memories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so some of the memories are so close to my life. Like, every time I hear a Mary J. Blige song, that's a, you know, I want to be happy. I'm supposed to be sad when I hear it now. So that's what makes it so complicated.
So when you heard about the indictment, on top of everything that we've heard about him over the years, was it a breaking point for you in any ways? Do you think your consumption will change moving forward? You still figuring it out? Like, I'm trying to get that kind of, like, sort of interior perspective from you.
Well, I'm not one to, like, put on Bad Boy music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's not like, for me, it's not like A Tribe Called Quest. It's not like Stevie Wonder. Yeah. I'm not putting it in my CD player or asking Alexa to play it, right? But I hear it on the radio. So the question is, if I hear Mary J. Blige, am I going to turn the radio? No.
Right.
Absolutely not. But I will remember. It's kind of like Bill Cosby. Like, I haven't stopped watching The Cosby Show only because it comes on television. But every time I see Bill Cosby, I'm reminded about what happened and what he did. And so it's just another part of my life as a Gen Xer that makes me sad. That's like, you know, could I stop listening to Michael Jackson and Jackson 5?
Because you wrote about Michael Jackson as well.
I did, and I can't. I mean, every time I hear Off the Wall, you know, my eyes well up because it's a part of my youth. I can't give up a part of myself.
Yeah, and I want to bring Eric into this conversation because you hear the conflict and the tension and the, and I mean, just so many of the emotions that Elizabeth is going through. Eric, can you talk about this broader issue and the conflict that so many fans have when someone that they loved their art so long throughout their life does something like Diddy has done or is accused of doing? And now you have to ask yourself, can you even enjoy the things you enjoyed in the past? Eric, your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first, I would say I think it's important that we're having this conversation because one reaction that people sometimes have is to just sort of ignore it from the get-go and say, oh, like these are two separate things, you know, the art and the artist, we can keep them totally separate. And so we should just not pay attention to this stuff. And I think that's a mistake. So the fact that we're, you know, having this conversation is itself valuable. The question about, you know, whether you as an individual can continue to enjoy the work, like Elizabeth was saying, that's a deeply personal question. I think it has to do with your relationship to the work, the role it's played in your life, those emotional connections she was talking about. You know, it's one thing if, you know, an artist's work doesn't really mean much to you, it's not a big deal to just sort of put it aside. You know, you might not care. But for people who are really, you know, deeply engaged with this work over long periods of time, I think it's important to recognize that the costs of giving it up are not negligible. It really means something to someone. One thing I would want to, you know, say about, you know, the sort of personal thought process of considering whether to, you know, keep engaging with this work is to acknowledge that engaging with the work can be a way of grappling with the allegations against the artist, about taking them seriously. You know, so if your immediate reaction is just to say like, oh, I've heard this terrible thing, I'm just never going to listen to that work again, you know, that can be a way of, you know, just sort of like putting the allegations to the side, putting them out of mind, you know, kind of like an out of sight, out of mind kind of situation. And so one, you know, morally positive thing about, you know, continuing to engage with the artist in a thoughtful way is that it's gonna keep those accusations in your mind. And that might spur you to, you know, do some more significant actions or take some more significant actions that might actually make a difference, you know.
And I'll quote you back to you here, Eric. You wrote, engaging with the work of immoral artists can be cathartic, not in the sense of expunging our emotions, but of clarifying them. And that's what we're asking our listeners this hour. Can you separate art and artists? Should you even try? What do you do when an artist that you love is accused of or convicted of doing something horrendous? Email us, studio2@whyy.org. You can call 888-477-9499. I want to bring in a caller now. And this caller, I believe, if this description here is correct, is themselves a DJ. So on line two, we have DJ007 who has a comment for us. DJ007, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
First and foremost, thank you for allowing me just a couple of minutes. I want to lead with the precursor that my feelings or opinions are only mine. They do not represent anybody that I work for. I just want to leave with that. Mm-hmm. All right? Cool. Okay. Now that I got that out the way, it is difficult. It is extremely difficult as a DJ to think of Bad Boy's catalog no longer being playable in certain environments. Like the guest said just before me, we're not just talking about Puff's work. If it was just Puff's work, I do not think that there would be such a discussion. But when we talk about everything Puff Daddy adjacent, we are talking about an extremely large body of work. And I say that feeling conflicted because as it sounds as if I maybe, you know, lean toward the being able to separate the music from the artist, I don't want to do that because I want to stand with those people that have been, you know, taken advantage of or not treated fairly by him. It's not an easy thing, especially for me and all the DJs who, you know, play for the masses.
Yeah. And thank you so much, DJ007. And I want to tell you this and get your take on this, Elizabeth, because I was at a party in Chicago. They were playing R. Kelly music. The dance floor was packed. And yet people were complaining to the DJ, why are you playing this music, knowing that R. Kelly is currently sitting in a jail cell for sexually assaulting women? There are others, okay, who have work. They've done things. They've built, you mentioned Bill Cosby. I mean, you think about the victims. I just want to, can you talk about that process? And then Eric, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that as well, because you're thinking about the victims when you're doing a two-step to R. Kelly.
Well, R. Kelly was, it's funny. R. Kelly was one of the artists that I was like, that's it. I'm not going to listen to him. I'm a cancel. Yeah. Like, I did not listen to R. Kelly.
That was where your line
was.
That's
where my line was. I was like, not doing R. Kelly. And, you know, but then I heard some R. Kelly this weekend, like just this weekend. I was like, that was a hot song. And so, because I hadn't heard it in a while.
Right.
The thing that's interesting about Puff that you were talking about, DJ 007, we don't even know if some of his artists were some of his victims at this point. So that's still out. You know, Usher, like I can't, I'm not. No, like, I love Usher. So, you know, there's so many.
I have tickets.
You know, but I need a girl. Does he not do that one song when he does his throwbacks now? I'm sure he has memories of it. You know, Justin Bieber. You know, there's so many people. We don't know who the victims were. Mm-hmm. So there's so much other speculation of other people who are close to him. So I'm not sure if we're going to get into that. So that's the
thing.
Let me
ask you something about R. Kelly, though. Mm-hmm. And it actually leads me into a broader question. And Eric, I'll get your thoughts on this as well. Because I think one of the problems that people have with R. Kelly's music is that they feel that the music itself, the message in the music, yeah, is used to, mm-hmm, launder the transgression, to make it seem like less of a transgression. And you can also get into this with the director Woody Allen, who has a film, Manhattan, in which he plays a character who has a romantic relationship with a 17-year-old. He is accused of doing similar types of things. And the idea is that the art is actually being used, like I said, to make that transgression seem less vile. Is that a line for you, Elizabeth?
I remember when the R. Kelly thing happened, what really upset me was that he was a predator and he was coming after 15-year-old girls. Mm-hmm. He was like, I think if I remember correctly, he was in malls. Right. He was like going and trolling after women. And I think because they were underage, there was something about them not having any agency. What Puff is accused of doing is heinous, is terrible. And this is not to make an excuse, but they weren't younger children. Like, they were, mm-hmm, everybody
were
was an
adults.
Adult.
They were adults.
Now, yeah, that doesn't mean that I think that I need to listen, hear, deal, mm-hmm, put on. But I think that's what
got
me,
you,
is that they were children involved.
Can I get Eric Mathis's thoughts now on that idea of when the art sort of, like, the stream of the art kind of crosses over with what the person is accused of doing, that there's some intermingling between the two. Does that complicate the response for the consumer, for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are the cases when it's clearest that the moral life of the artist really does matter to our understanding of the work, right? So, you know, putting aside questions about whether or not you feel comfortable continuing to engage with the work or whether you can still enjoy it, I think in cases like, you know, R. Kelly's Age Ain't Nothing But a Number, for example, like, you know, if you're trying to put aside the facts about the life of the artist when you're engaging with that work, you're missing something important about the work. Like, you're like misunderstanding it, right? You're not really taking it seriously for what it is. I mean, in that case is particularly, you know, perverse, right? Because he's like putting those words in the mouth of Aaliyah, to whom he was, you know, secretly married when she was 15. Mm. You know, so I think those are the cases that I think are often the clearest, as, you know, that you can use in arguments against people who say, like, oh, well, you know, yeah, maybe people don't want to keep listening to this, but it actually doesn't matter to whether it's good work. Actually, I think it does matter because it influences how we interpret the work, and that's part of how we evaluate it.
Yeah, and you can join the conversation. Do you still listen to music or watch movies by people who have done really bad things? Can you separate the art from the artist? Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And I want to bring in one of our callers. We have Aaron from the Main Line, Philadelphia, and you have a comment or a question. What is it? You're on Studio 2.
I have two comments. One, as relates to Sean Combs at the moment, he hasn't been found guilty yet. So I think that that's something that should be brought up. Mm-hmm. I think he probably will be, but he hasn't been yet. So, mm-hmm, I think we should put a pause on that a little bit. But as relates to separate the art from the artist, I think that's directly related on timing and profit. So that if you've downloaded the art prior to finding out about a person's perceived or moral misdeeds, in your opinion, I think you can freely listen because they're not going to make more money if you've already downloaded it. The issue is if you haven't, and if every time you listen to a song, they get a click, a royalty, or every time you watch a show or a movie, they get a royalty, then I think that's really a question. And for myself, I would decide against that if the person acted in a way that was found that I find to be immoral.
Thank you, Aaron. From
another
Mainline.
Great call. Can I get your thoughts on that? Because commerce enters the equation here, and like it's hard to put a price on morality.
But
should you? I mean, should you be thinking about the economics of all of this when you make your personal decisions about whether to listen or to stream?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a totally natural reaction to have, but I think generally speaking, I don't feel particularly compelled by the economic argument because, You know, we're talking about hugely successful artists who are, you know, multi-millionaires. Whether or not you stream a song by Diddy is like irrelevant, right? Like, you're not going to make any difference to his bottom line. And you might say, well, maybe if we all did it. Right. But if that's the argument you want to make, then I think you need to do a lot more than just make a personal decision to stop, you know,
like organize a boycott, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Like, if you think it's important to, you know, boycott an artist, then there's a lot more, I think, that needs to be done than just saying like, oh, well, I'm going to sort of like keep my hands clean here. Now, that's not to say that there aren't good reasons why you might have personally to stop engaging with the work. I'm just not sure that like sticking it, you know, to them, like hitting them where it hurts, you know, kind of with the economic argument is going to be the one that carries the day.
Yeah. And I want to read a couple of comments we received. Hector on Instagram says, I believe that most folks have selective outrage, whether in the arts or their daily lives. Most people are influenced by convenience instead of moral indignation. For example, numerous corporations, you de facto slave labor or support a genocide, but people continue to patronize the business. Art as a business is very much like that.
Hmm.
I'd love to bring in another caller. We have Jerry from Townsend, Delaware. Jerry, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, when I was back in the 80s, I was listening to this motivation series from this guy, Jack Canfield, and he referenced several of these people with heroic stories, overcoming odds and stuff like that. And this one had O.J. Simpson, Lance Armstrong, and a gentleman named Stu Leonard. And all of these guys got in trouble. And at that time, they were heroes. And now we look back at them as disgraced celebrities and stuff. So you can't really expect that much from people, especially, I think, very ambitious and very motivated people. They oftentimes do things that we are, you know, that are disgraceful, and they themselves, you know, oftentimes say they don't want to be held up as role models.
Yeah. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for that. And this, Eric, I think, comes to the other question that I have. I mean,
that's interesting.
Where's the line? Sort of like, what level of crime or what level of act does someone have to partake in or be accused of or commit for you to go through this analysis? Because it's not just saying something that people react negatively to. It's something more. So where is the line, and how do you kind of figure that out, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I think this also relates to, you know, who are we talking about drawing the line here? Are we just talking about, you know, consumers of art? Or are we talking about others as well? Because as important as I think this conversation is, and, you know, as much as we, you know, want to think about this in relation to our own actions, right? What is it okay for me to do, or me, you know, what art can I engage with? There's also a worry that if we sort of focus too much on that question, we're going to miss this other really important question, which is, what are the responsibilities of people in the industry?
Yeah, the institutions.
Who, you know, probably, you know, knew about this, allowed it to happen, continue working with these figures. So, you know, I think that one really important thing to advocate for is that when we're talking about individuals who have been, you know, credibly accused of, you know, abuse by multiple people, you know, people who are in positions of power in the industry can make a big difference by deciding not to keep working with those people. And that's going to send a much bigger signal than, you know, some, you know, individual deciding not to, you know, stream a song on Spotify.
You're nodding along, Elizabeth Wellington. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, part of the run-up to this whole Puff allegation, there were a lot of articles that were written in the Times or Essence or different magazines by women who had been threatened, journalists, women who'd come in contact with Diddy and were afraid. And so they spoke up, like they spoke up back in the day, but the industry protected them. And plus they wanted to get these stories, you know, if you want to put Puff on the cover of a magazine, you know, then he storms in and wants it to be a certain way, and he was threatening people. I mean, he's had a long history. Yeah. I mean, that's why it's not new. I think Wendy Williams early on in this, you know, had a show. I remember when she got run out of New York and came to Philly. She got run out of New York and came to Philly on and was on the radio after she made some disparaging comments about Puff. So people kind of spoke up, but he was such a titan in the industry at the time that, and he paid, you know, he lined so many people's pockets. You know, he was paying people. You know, he was the entry. And the backup to me, the sad part about that to me is that you had all these young people. I think Chris Brown even said recently that he wanted to audition for Puff and he didn't think he was talented enough. It came up on Instagram or something. And, you know, all these people who really wanted to be a part of the bad boy world mm-hmm. because they wanted to get put on. And getting put on, you know, kind of ruined and like they became big stars, but what you had to give up for it. So
it made me think of Harvey Weinstein, mm-hmm. the same type it of is. Thing in order to get put on
a
and
gatekeeper.
To get. Yeah, yeah, it was like this was a gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. You had to sacrifice some things in order to get through that gate.
And I think we have a caller who wants to talk about Harvey Weinstein. I'm like 95% sure. And we're about to hit a break. So we're going to bring in that call after the break. But the topic this hour is art and artists. Can you separate the two? Should you try to separate the two, mm-hmm. especially when artists are accused of doing heinous things? We're talking with Elizabeth Wellington, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist, and Eric Mathis, associate professor at Wellesley College. And of course, we're hearing from you. Email us studio2@whyy.org or give us a call 888-477-9499. Very quick break, and we will be right back on Studio 2.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
And this is Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are back talking about whether you can enjoy the music, movies, and art of immoral people. Hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs was arrested last week on a number of charges, including sex trafficking, which has made a lot of people think about this question once again. So do you still listen to music or watch movies by people who have done or been accused of doing really bad things? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Let me reintroduce our guests. Joining us this hour, we have Elizabeth Wellington, a Philadelphia Inquirer columnist who writes about gender, race, fashion, culture, and wellness. We also have Eric Mathis, associate professor at Wellesley College and the author of the book Drawing the Line, What to Do with the Work of Immoral Artists from Museums to the Movies. And as I teased before the break, I want to bring in a caller now. This is Jay from the Main Line. Big hour for the Main Line, by the way.
I know. Thanks for listening, guys.
Jay, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I have a comment. It's difficult, you know, it's a difficult question, but generally what I try to do is that if I feel that listening to the creation or the product of the artist primarily benefits that individual, I would stop. On the other hand, when you think about somebody like Harvey Weinstein with the a film industry where there's hundreds of people involved in these productions who had no part in what went on and will be hurt, like, say, if there was a boycott of that studio.
Collateral damage, so right.
When it hurts a lot of innocent people, I try to be more forgiving than if it's just avoiding profiting the one artist who committed the potential crimes.
That seems like a reasonable, logical way to approach
very
it.
That's thoughtful.
Jay from the Main Line. What do you think about that, Eric Mathis, this idea of, well, I don't want there to be sort of collateral damage in my personal, you know, potential boycott of an artist?
Yeah, I think that makes sense, especially right in the context of those collaborative works or works by producers who are, you know, elevating, you know, new artists or other artists, you know, in the film industry, like the caller said, like all of the people involved in Harvey Weinstein films. But I think this is a place where we can make a distinction between, you know, how we regard their past work and what we want to do moving forward, right? So, you know, we could say like, yeah, like we don't want to, you know, hurt the career or sort of like take away from the contributions of artists who are in, you know, movies that Weinstein produced. But we can consistently say that and say, but, you know, the industry can say, but we're not working with Weinstein anymore. I mean,
right.
That's obviously easy to say under the current circumstances for him. But like, even if he were not, you know, indicted, that could be something that we could say in that kind of case.
I want to read this comment from Mary, who lives in Pennsylvania, and says things have changed. Mary says she believes we don't hold all celebrities accountable for their actions anymore. As an example, she points to a celebrity who was accused of serious crimes, but somehow became president and now wants to run for office again. She's wondering if we've just gotten more tolerant of bad behavior or if we just don't care as much about the past. And Elizabeth, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Have we just gotten more tolerant? Because people have been finding outs and ways of saying, well, well, this person didn't do this thing and that wasn't that bad. And we even had one person comment to say, hey, well, it depends on the crime. If it was more of a fun crime, I wouldn't necessarily hold them accountable. How do we hold folks accountable when we feel some kind of way, Elizabeth?
I don't know. I mean, I think in the case of the difference between Puff Daddy, Diddy, and let's be clear, what the man did was horrible and terrible. Like it was an awful crime. Going forward, I would not, and I think I agree with the caller, I would not put any money in his pocket. The issue, but the difference between Diddy and the other former president is that he's running for office that's going to affect everybody. Mm-hmm. Like he is a convicted criminal, basically, mm-hmm. who is running to be the president of the United States. That's a big, like, that's a big moral job. Like you, like it's comparing that to a music producer. He might have a lot of influence. He might have a lot of sway. He might be able to, you know, one of the things that rap music did at that time was influence how men treated women, mm-hmm. how men treated work. I mean, it was very influential as the attitudes that we had. But those days are over. Like at this point, we are all in our 50s. We are grown. We are fully formed human beings.
Yeah.
And so now, to not listen to something by Bad Boy is part, because it's such a big part of the culture, it's basically denying a part of your life.
Yeah,
your
a
past.
Whole 20 years. 20,
a whole 20
years
of your past. Like not taking away your good memories. But moving forward, but if you look at this and move forward, like we're trying to move forward with a president or trying to move forward with government and officials. And I think to speak to Eric's point, it's what we do moving forward that makes sense.
Mm. Eric, maybe this is it's kind of funny to bring this up at this point in the conversation, but I feel like we still haven't fully asked the question, like, what is the value of art? Like, why should we care at all whether or not art from the past is enjoyed in the future, whether by an individual or in mass? Like, what is, boy, talk about a big question. What is the value? what is the value of art? And I guess maybe more to the point, what is the risk of a burying or ignoring a piece of art to you know, human society, to the culture moving forward?
Yeah, that is definitely a big question. But to give it too pat of an answer, right? Art is like one of the fundamental modes of human expression. Right? Mm-hmm. It's one of the primary ways in which we think about and tell people about our values and what we care about. And the art that other people make is valuable for us because for those of us who aren't artists, one of the ways that we can sort of express those values ourselves is through the work of other people, right? You think about, some like lovesick teenager, right? Singing a song to somebody that they have a crush on or reading them a poem or whatever. It's like they're borrowing this work, right, from somebody else, because I think it expresses something about themselves. And I think that's part of the reason why we get so embroiled in these questions about which art to continue to engage with, is because we think that it says something about us. It speaks to, you know, our own values. And, you know, that's really important. And I think that can, you know, pertain to how we answer these questions in terms of like what we're doing in private versus what we do publicly. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, you know, we have a lot of moral attitude when it comes to how we engage with the arts in private, right? If a work, you know, no longer speaks to you because of an allegation against an artist, it's totally fine to not engage with it. But if you also find yourself not bothered, I think it's also totally fine to, you know, keep reading or listening or watching. But that's quite different from what you do in terms of like engaging with artworks publicly, right? So if you're, you know, organizing a film, you know, viewing for your local library or something, you know, you might not want to choose Manhattan for your for your movie, because that might express something to people, right, that conflicts with, you know, other values that you might have or that you don't want to express.
But how about like in cases where sort of the individual and the institutional intersect? So I'm thinking about Chuck Close, artist. Yeah. We don't have to get into all the accusations against Chuck Close, but let's say a major museum, in order to sort of consume Chuck Close, some museum first has to make the decision, you would think, I am going to exhibit Chuck Close's work. And so if I'm then going to the exhibit, I'm in some ways, yes, it's a personal decision, but I'm supporting an institutional decision in some ways. How do I kind of navigate that?
Yeah, good. So that's a really complicated question. I'll try to give a brief answer. But
I'm giving you lots of complicated questions here. Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's great. So like one of the things that we worry about when it comes to work in museums, for example, is that we're honoring the artist.
Right.
We're sort of like putting them up on a pedestal because, you know, there's very limited space, and we're saying like this is something that's worth your attention when you come to the museum. I think that very power can be flipped on its head by institutions if they are willing to take seriously the moral life of the artist. So, you know, historically, it has not been common for wall text in museums to talk about the moral life of the artist, but it certainly could be. And one of the things that institutions like museums can do is contribute to sort of shaping norms about what's relevant to evaluating and thinking about art. So, you know, if the museum is more transparent about these aspects of the moral life of the artist, it gives us an opportunity when we're viewing the work to not just, you know, put the artist on a pedestal, but actually, you know, to view the work in the context of these facts about their life and think about the relationship between the two and take those moral accusations seriously. So, you know, one other thing I'll say about this is just that, especially when it comes to historical artists who, you know, have been subject to moral criticism, like Gauguin, for instance, there's also been, you know, many contemporary artists who have explicitly grappled with that legacy in their own work.
Right.
So, you know, Amanda Wiley has a series that is like engaging with some aspects of Gauguin's work. He himself has, you know, recently faced accusations. So that's a complex case.
Yeah.
One worry that you might have about sort of taking work off the walls, you know, not sort of making it available, but to people to see, is that it can then undercut these artistic responses to their work by other artists, because then there's no context for understanding the work that they're making.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, what you said, Eric, makes me think about H.P. Lovecraft, a fantasy and horror writer from the 19th century. Lots of his writings have elements of race. He held openly racist views, which were common at the time that he lived and wrote. Yet his writing and style is being resurrected in many ways. And there's new exhibits. There was a new series on HBO that sort of like made plays on his work. Is there a way to give new life to art that may have been created by someone we would currently deem as immoral, yet at the same time, like, let people know about that immorality?
Yeah, right. So like the Lovecraft Country was an interesting case because that show is explicitly grappling with the racist legacy of Lovecraft. And there have been other examples of works in literature as well that have tried to, you know, really confront that head on. And I think we can distinguish between, you know, that kind of critical engagement with the work and, you know, just putting the, you know, author on a pedestal. So for a long time, the World Fantasy Awards were like a little bust of Lovecraft, right? So it's like you win this award, you get, you know, a little Lovecraft effigy. And they stopped using the Lovecraft bust for giving this award. I think that's, you know, that's a good move, because that seems to be just honoring the figure. It's not sort of critical engagement at all. So I think we can distinguish between these sort of two different ways of thinking about that legacy.
Yeah.
Email from Gloria, who says, since most of the music and art I enjoy is by women,
yeah,
I have not had to address this issue very often. But that is an interesting point by Gloria. Stephanie from Yaden says, we cannot also penalize everyone the artist has ever worked with. We got at that idea earlier. So Elizabeth Wellington, we're wrapping up now. You came in, we started, we asked you about your reaction to the latest news. You've been listening to this conversation now. Do you feel like you have any insights moving forward that you can apply to artists that you've enjoyed that have been part of your life? Like, do you feel, what are you taking away from what you've heard from Eric, from our callers? Where's your mind at right now?
You hit me with the hard questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still pretty kind of where I started squarely. I think art is so personal.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's certain things that, I mean, I enjoyed these artists because of the nostalgia. I mean, yeah. I watched Little House on the Prairie and Michael Landon has issues. So, like, yeah. it's so
unavoidable in many ways.
Yeah, it's so vast and unavoidable. But I do agree with Eric completely. I'm so glad he was on because I think, you know, we can look at these artists critically. We can discuss the work that they've done critically. We can be mindful of how we move forward with them.
How we present their work.
And how we present their work. And I think that's the most important part because I, you know, as a 19-year-old listening to Craig Mack that Puff produced, I didn't know.
Yeah.
But as an adult, now I can decide I can't put money in your pocket.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Elizabeth Wellington, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist who writes about gender, race, fashion, culture, and wellness. Thank you so much for your insights this hour, as well as Eric Mathis, associate professor at Wellesley College, author of the book Drawing the Line, What to Do with the Work of Immoral Artists from Museums to the Movies. And that is it for Studio 2 this hour,
yes,
Cherry.
And thank you to all our callers and everybody who emailed and posted online. That wraps our show. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Al Banks engineered today's show from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you tomorrow.